Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Friday, September 27th edition of Money Matters, the program all about money, how we earn it, how we spend it, how we save it, and how we invest it. I'm Jeff Eisman, and today I'll be reading from a recent edition of Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. The first article is one that is entitled, "This is the Best Way to Recession-Proof Your Retirement. Take these steps so you won't have to worry about how stocks perform." And it's an article by Alex Langone. An estimated $2.4 trillion disappeared almost overnight from Americans' 401ks and IRAs when the market crashed in 2008, devastating many of their retirement prospects. Stocks have since recovered spectacularly, and in March, the bull market celebrated its 10th birthday since then. Still, there's a growing sense that this rally is on borrowed time, and as economists warn that another recession is likely to happen in the next 2 to 3 years, many people are asking themselves what they can do to prepare for the next financial disaster. Those who are near retirement are especially vulnerable to drops in the stock market owing to the lack of time they have to recover, and the fact that, in the case of those already retired, they're drawing down savings instead of working and adding to them. But if you plan ahead, you can build a financial buffer to help ensure you survive the passing storm. Here are a few basic steps you should take. First, build your cushion. If you commit to an emergency fund, it protects the rest of the financial plan, says Sharon Allen, president and co-founder of Sterling Wealth Management based in Champaign, Illinois. She suggests a minimum of 3 to 6 months' expenses for this fund. Once you've filled that emergency savings bucket, aim to pay down as much debt as possible. That's key to feeling secure once you leave the workforce, because it means that less of your savings is tied up in fixed expenses, says Patty Black, a partner at Bridgeworth, a wealth management firm based in Birmingham, Alabama. It's much simpler to adjust your discretionary expenses like vacations as opposed to saying, "Hey, I've decided I'm not going to pay my mortgage this month," she notes. Generally, it's a good idea to tackle your highest interest rate debt first. Financial advisors are divided on whether you should pay off your mortgage before retiring. Black's opinion: if the only choice of funds to pay down the mortgage is a retirement account, a 401k or IRA, I don't recommend proceeding with paying off the loan. Secondly, tweak your asset allocation. If you're on the cusp of retirement or have just retired, consider diversifying and rebalancing your portfolio to limit your exposure to market volatility. If you're going to need your money within 5 years, I recommend putting it into a much safer portfolio, says Teresa Ghilarducci, a labor economist and an expert on retirement security. That means putting the money you'll need for the next few years in cash or cash equivalents such as savings accounts, CDs, and short-term bond funds. This approach doesn't require that you be conservative with your entire portfolio, however. You'll need stocks growth to outpace inflation over time, and that usually means maintaining a healthy equity allocation. Allen recommends in the 60 to 80% range throughout retirement. And lastly, consider part-time work. Part-time work helps protect you if a recession catches you off guard. If you're earning enough income to live on, you can leave your portfolio untouched instead of withdrawing funds on a declining balance, a surefire way to drain your savings quickly. Just be aware of how this extra income could affect the taxation of your Social Security benefits if you've already claimed. Financial considerations aside, having a job or a hobby gets you out of the house, helps your mind keep sharp, and offers you the opportunity to socialize and make meaningful connections within your community. And if you find yourself behind the eight ball, says Allen, know that it's never too late to start preparing for retirement, regardless of the economic climate. So that's some pretty sage advice. It's pretty standard. I've read that same kind of thing from different writers in different weeks about the three steps, and making sure you have a backup fund that will be so many months worth of your income and so on. Okay, the next article is in connection with that, and it's under the Economy Watch section of the magazine, and it asks the question, is a recession on the way? The recent dip in long-term bond yields below short-term yields isn't cause for panic, however, and it's an article by Ryan Ermey of the Kiplinger staff. Market watchers broke into a collective sweat recently when the yield on 10-year treasuries sank below the 3-month T-bill yield. When yields on short-term debt exceed those on longer-term bonds, the yield curve, a representation of interest rates on bonds of varying maturities, is said to be inverted. A little perspiration is understandable. An inverted yield curve has preceded each of the past 7 recessions, dating back to the mid-60s. An inversion is considered a recession indicator because although short-term rates are driven by current Federal Reserve policy, longer-term rates reflect bond investors' expectations for inflation and future economic growth. When investors believe that the economy will weaken, they tend to pile into the safe haven of longer-term treasuries, locking in higher rates while they can. In doing so, they bid up the price of long maturity bonds, driving down yields, bond prices and yields above in opposite direct, driving down yields, bond prices and yields move in opposite directions. A yield curve inversion is an extreme and rare no confidence vote. As with any economy bellwether, the yield curve isn't foolproof. Although all recessions since the 60s have followed inversions, not all inversions have led to recessions, and there is little predictability as to when a recession will hit or how long it will last. Since 1968, the time between the inversion and eventual recession has ranged from 5 to 16 months. Moreover, March's inversion wasn't severe, a difference of only a few hundredths of a percentage point. Or was it long-lasting? It has since flipped back. Should the long end dip more than 0.5 percentage points below the short end, it would be cause for much greater concern, says LPL senior market strategist Ryan Dietrich. Whether the recent inversion is a blip or a harbinger of recession remains to be seen. Regardless, investors should consider it a sign that things are closer to the end than the beginning of the economic cycle, says Sam Stovall, chief investment strategist at research firm CFRA. By this past July, it has been the longest economic expansion in history. Things like that don't last forever, right? He says. So we keep hearing that over and over again, the idea of the fact that this run can't last forever, but continues on, doesn't it? Okay. Moving on to the next article. This one's a little longer, and it has to do with retirement, but it's a kind of a little twist on it. And the headline reads, "Suddenly Retired." Life throws you a curveball, and you end up leaving the workforce much earlier than planned. Here's what to do next. And it's an article by Eileen Ambrose of the Kiplinger staff. Early in his career, Drew Parker's goal was to retire at age 57, or at least be financially prepared to quit working by then. But 3 years ago, at age 55, his retirement came sooner than expected when his employer, Nordstrom, restructured and offered him a buyout. Parker, of Mercer Island, Washington, says he took the buyout because he believed it might be the last time the retailer offered severance packages with job cuts. So he left Nordstrom, where he had worked for 16 years, with about 6 months' salary, and hunted for another job. "I gave it a good effort, but I got almost no responses," says Parker, who had been a merchandise financial manager working with Nordstrom's buyers. "In this area, the competition is tough, and at my age, it was much, much tougher." Like Parker, many older workers find themselves suddenly retired, sometimes years ahead of their target date. According to a 2018 survey by the Employee Benefit Research Institute, nearly one-third of workers predict they will remain in the workforce until age 70 or older, and only 10% expect to retire before age 60. But in reality, only 7% of retirees surveyed stayed on the job until at least 70, and more than one-third had quit working before age 60. Many end up retiring early because of a job loss, or a health problem, or caregiving responsibilities. It happens more often than people realize, says James Bayard, a certified financial planner in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Given that it does happen, everyone should have a preliminary plan for it, just in case. So the first step he recommends is take a deep breath. When retirement comes unexpectedly, the initial impulse is often to make drastic financial moves that could have adverse repercussions, say all financial planners, it seems. For example, draining a 401k will trigger taxes and, depending on your age, early withdrawal penalties. If you work with a financial advisor, ask your planner to run the numbers to see where you stand and advise you of your options. If you're a do-it-yourselfer, your first step should be to set up a budget based on your new circumstances. Review your sources of income, such as pension, savings, severance, or investments. Next, look at your expenses, how they'll change now that you're not working, and whether you need to cut them. Online budgeting tools such as Mint.com and PersonalCapital.com can help. In Parker's case, his wife continues to work at Nordstrom as a business process manager. The question was, could we live on one salary when we had always lived on two, he says. For them, the answer was yes. Some expenses disappeared or shrank. For instance, paying for yard maintenance and child care for the Parker's 12-year-old son was no longer necessary. Auto insurance became less expensive because one of the family's cars was being driven less. Parker no longer saves for retirement, but his wife continues to, in addition to putting money aside each month in a 529 college savings plan for their son. So after taking that deep breath, the next step is consider part-time work. Even if your full-time job is no more, consider finding a part-time gig to bring in some money. Every dollar you earn is one less that you'll have to pull from savings and investments. It might make the difference between what makes a plan work or not work, says Stephen Novak, a financial advisor in New York City. Some part-time jobs even come with benefits. Costco and Starbucks, for instance, offer part-timers their health insurance plan and a 401k plan with a company match. For some people, a job loss can also be an opportunity to become become their own boss. Parker markets a financial planning tool called the Complete Retirement Planner. He had developed a spreadsheet to track his finances in retirement and show how they would change if, for example, he took Social Security early or his wife lost her job. Friends wanted to use it too, so he added more scenarios to fit others and then started selling it online in mid-2017. Next, tap accounts to minimize taxes. If income from part-time work or a spouse's job isn't enough, and you've gone through your severance or emergency fund, you might have to start drawing down your investment or retirement accounts. The standard advice is to minimize taxes by withdrawing money first from your taxable accounts, especially if your income is now low enough to qualify for tax-free capital gains. Gains on investments held for more than a year will be taxed for most investors at a rate of 0%, 15%, or 20%. For 2019, the 0% rate will apply for taxpayers with taxable income up to $39,375 on individual returns and $78,750 on joint tax returns. Next, tap your tax-deferred retirement accounts such as 401ks or traditional IRAs. Withdrawals are taxed as ordinary income at rates ranging from 10% to 37%. Try to save Roth IRAs for last so your investments can grow tax-free just as long as possible. The next step is to avoid retirement plan penalties. If you're forced to retire before age 59 and a half and need to tap your savings, be mindful of early withdrawal penalties and strategies to avoid them. You can withdraw your contributions at any time from a Roth without a penalty. You can avoid taxes and a penalty on the earnings, too, as long as you have owned the Roth for 5 years and you're at least 59 and a half. If you pull money out of a 401k or traditional IRA before age 59 and a half, you could be subject to a 10% early withdrawal penalty. But with a 401k, if you leave your job in or after the year you turn 55, you won't pay a penalty for early withdrawals from the 401k associated with that job. This option disappears once you roll the 401k into a traditional IRA, says Scott Bishop, a CFP in Houston. Drawing money from a traditional IRA before age 59 and a half can trigger a 10% penalty and should be a last resort. But some early retirees in need of money may have no other option. You can avoid the penalty by using the so-called 72T rule, in which you agree to take out substantially equal periodic payments from the IRA for 5 years or until you turn 59 and a half, whichever is longer. The IRS offers three methods: amortization, annuitization, and required minimum distribution to calculate your payments based on your account balance and life expectancy. Your payments are locked in once you start, although the IRS permits a one-time switch from the amortization or annuitization method to the required minimum distribution calculation if, for example, you want to reduce the size of your withdrawals. You have to look at the 72T very carefully before you do it, says Bishop. If you violate the rules, you will owe a retroactive 10% penalty on your withdrawals. To give yourself more flexibility, Bishop recommends splitting a large IRA into at least two accounts, more if the balance is very large. You can start your 72T payments from one IRA, and if later you need extra income, you can start 72T payments on the other, he says. The next step, review your portfolio. An early retirement can throw your mix of stocks, bonds, and cash way out of whack. You might have been investing heavily in stocks, figuring you wouldn't need that money for 10 years or so. But if you must start drawing from your portfolio early, you'll need to invest the money you'll be spending in the next year or two more conservatively, so it won't be at risk if the stock market tumbles even further, says Rand Sparrow, a CFP in Lexington, Massachusetts. He suggests parking cash you'll need in the next few months in a money market fund from an FDIC-insured online bank that pays a healthy interest rate, and investing money needed in a year or two in short-term CDs and U.S. Treasuries. But don't get too conservative with your portfolio. You'll still need the growth that stocks provide to keep up with inflation for possibly decades. The next step is take Social Security sooner or later. Question: if you have no other sources of income, you may have to apply for Social Security retirement benefits as early as possible, maybe at age 62. Taking benefits at 62 also makes sense if you're in poor health and don't expect to live for decades in retirement. However, your benefits will be reduced by as much as 30% compared with what you would have received if you waited until your full retirement age, which is 66 or 67 for workers now in their 50s and early 60s. If longevity is in your genes or you're married, delaying Social Security can provide generous long-term rewards. For every year you delay Social Security beyond your full retirement age, your benefit grows by 8% until age 70. that's likely a higher return than you'd earn from an investment portfolio, says Mark Fonville, a certified financial planner in Williamsburg, Virginia. And for couples having the higher earner, higher earner delay Social Security until age 70 ensures that the survivor will get the largest possible benefit. Next, cover health care. If you lost your job, if you lost your insurance along with your job, you'll need to find coverage until age 65 when you're eligible for Medicare. If you're married, you might be eligible to join your spouse's workplace plan. Or you can maintain coverage under COBRA, the federal law that allows you to stay on your employer's plan, for up to 18 months after leaving your job. But you must pay your share and the employer's share of the premiums, which can be steep. You might find a better deal through your state's health care exchange. You don't have to wait for open enrollment if you lost your job. Generally, if you don't have access to a workplace plan, including a spouse's, you may also qualify for a subsidy that could reduce your premiums by thousands of dollars annually. To get this subsidy, you must fall within certain income limits, a threshold that you're more likely to meet if you're not collecting a paycheck. For 2019, you can receive a subsidy if your modified adjusted gross income is up to $48,560 for singles, $65,840 for a couple, and $100,400 for a family of four. You go to the Health Insurance Marketplace Calculator at www.kff.org to see if you qualify for the subsidy and the estimated subsidy amount. If your household income is slightly over the threshold, you still may be able to reduce it so you can qualify for the subsidy. Contributing to a health savings account or boosting contributions to a working spouse's 401k can reduce modified adjusted gross income just enough. The amount you withdraw from tax-deferred accounts matters too. Even a small reduction in withdrawals could make you eligible for that subsidy. Another option, particularly if you don't qualify for a subsidy, is to shop for a policy through an online broker or buy directly from the insurer. The next of the steps, see if you qualify for disability. If you must retire because of a disability, you may be eligible for Social Security Disability Insurance, which will provide a monthly check to you. To qualify, you must have a medical condition that will keep you from doing basic work activities for at least a year. In most cases, you must have worked 5 out of the past 10 years before your disability began and stayed long enough in jobs in which you paid into the Social Security system. You can apply for this online at ssa.gov. Your initial application may be denied, but you can appeal. Bishop, the Houston CFP, says the application he filed on behalf of his father, a hospital administrator who suffered a stroke at age 58, was indeed denied, so he hired an elder law attorney to appeal. That worked, and Bishop now advises others to seek professional help either to handle the initial application or, certainly, an appeal. Generally, once you've received your Social Security disability for 2 years, you'll qualify for Medicare, even if you're younger than age 65. And the last step is downsize. If you need to make bigger cuts to your living expenses, consider moving to a smaller place, or even to a cheaper state. That's what Lydia and Chuck Jenkins of New Bern, North Carolina did after both of them retired because their jobs had been eliminated. Chuck, who's 65, lost his job as a network engineer for a telecommunications company in 2016. Lydia, who's 64, worked in human resources at a biotech company until early this year, when her position was replaced by an automated system. In February, the couple relocated from Thurmont, Maryland to North Carolina. They now live in a 3-bedroom house that's about half the size of their Maryland house, but their mortgage is less than 1/3 of their old payment. Plus, taxes are lower in North Carolina, says Chuck. And you can find out about places with the cheaper taxes at kiplinger.com/links/retiree-tax-map for the most and least tax-friendly states. So that's quite a few steps and quite a bit to do think about, but when those out-of-the-blue plan upsetters happen, sometimes drastic measures must be taken. Okay, moving on to the next article. And this one is more on the investment side. It's an article that's written regularly by a contributor to the magazine, James Glassman. And the headline this month says, "Don't be afraid of emerging markets." In my February 2017 column, I wrote that the stocks of emerging markets, which had been languishing for 6 years, present a special opportunity. It was a good call, but only temporarily. That year, the MSCI Emerging Markets Index returned 37.3%, while Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, the U.S. benchmark, returned only 21.8%. In 2018, however, the stocks of emerging markets got clobbered, performing far worse than those in the U.S. or other developed nations. Over the past 10 years, MSCI Emerging Markets has returned just 8.0% annualized, compared with 15.2% for the S&P 500. This disparity is shocking. You can't just blame China, the largest emerging market by far. Although China's gross domestic product growth rate has slid from double digits as recently as 2011 to an estimated 6.3% for 2019, its stock market has outperformed emerging markets as a whole. Other developing economies in Asia have been sluggish. Markets in Latin America and the Middle East have also disappointed. But markets are about the future, not the past. And the future belongs to the aspiring, not to the mature. The forces of economic and demographic change are inexorable. In 1960, the U.S. represented 40% of the global GDP. Today, the proportion is just 24% and is in fact falling. In 1960, Americans were 6% of the world's population. Today, they're just 4.3%. I like China's prospects, but that market is explored elsewhere in this issue. So I'll focus on the two-thirds of assets in the MSCI EM that are not invested in Chinese shares. Many emerging countries, such as Brazil, have suffered from poor governance. Others, such as Thailand, are threatened by new U.S. trade policies. But investors can't be frozen in the moment. Emerging markets have the long-term advantage of rising populations and, as education and technology improve, rising productivity. Since the end of the Great Recession, gross GDP in Western Europe and Japan has been growing at an annual rate between 1 and 1.5% on average. The U.S. has been growing at about 2.2%, a bit more last year because of the tax cut. While those growth rates appear to be the new normal for developed markets, emerging markets economies have the potential to grow at rates of 4% or more. And emerging market stocks have been beaten up so badly in recent years that, unlike those in the U.S., they offer significant value right now. A good example is Brazil, the fifth largest country in the world by population, eighth by GDP. The exchange-traded fund iShares MSCI Brazil, CAPT, has declined in 5 of the past 8 years and has returned a measly 2.2% annualized for the past decade. Corruption and bad management have infested the government, and there's no guarantee that Brazil's unconventional new president, Jair Bolsonaro, can pull the country out of the doldrums. But gloom has been built into share prices. The price-earnings ratio of its Brazil index, based on year-ahead projected earnings, is 11, compared with 17 for the U.S. The iShares ETF is a good way to invest with an expense ratio of 0.59% and a dividend yield of 2.7%. But the fund is heavy on natural resource firms that depend on commodity prices rather than on a pickup in Brazil's own economy. Fortunately, unlike most other emerging markets, Brazil has an abundance of stocks listed on the U.S. Stock Exchange, trading as American depository receipts. So he seems to think that Brazil is a good idea. Now he goes on to say, India beckons. India has 1/7 the GDP of the United States and more than 4 times the population. The Economist magazine forecasts that India GDP will increase 7.4% this year, faster than any of the 41 other countries in the magazine's surveys. Unlike Brazil, India's stock market has been relatively buoyant over the past decade, but still flat in 2015, 2016, and 2018. Opportunities abound, and you can take advantage of them through the closed-end fund, India Fund, a particular bargain because it currently trades at a 9% discount to the net asset value of the shares it owns. Indonesia is the 4th most populous country in the world, with an economy growing at a 5.2% clip. The best stock for U.S. investors is probably PT Telekomunikasi Indonesia, which provides mobile phone and Wi-Fi services and trades on the New York Stock Exchange as an ADR with a 3.5% yield. There are dozens of emerging markets, ETFs, closed-end funds, and mutual funds. Some focus on individual countries from Egypt to Greece. All of them can be looked into, and you should do your homework, but they do seem promising. I have argued in the past that you can't go too far wrong with an all-U.S. portfolio. True, but once more, I believe that emerging markets present a special opportunity. The stocks are depressed, and the U.S. and other developed nations have not demonstrated that they will ever resume consistent economic growth rates above 3% or more than minuscule population gains. Emerging markets are volatile, but for the long term, you need their stocks and funds in your portfolio. So that's what Mr. Glassman recommends. Well, that brings us to the end of our time this week. As usual, you can reach us here at WRRS with any comments or questions you might have. Our number is 513-487-4245. This has been Jeff Eisman for Money Matters. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a great weekend.